$1,000 question, Mort. Peanut is back at the station doing everything she can to find out. You see my article today? It was the front page. I haven't seen the paper yet, Mort. Sorry, what's your headline? Mowgli lives. He swelled up with pride. I love referencing the classics. Anywho, it got me a call from the National Enquirer. Ellie winced. She hadn't thought about the sensational angle to this story. Flying Wolf Girl lands in Rainforest Town. This wasn't just local news. And now, Julia was involved. Oops. Did you ask people to contact us with information on her possible identity? Mort looked stung.
Of course. I'm a professional, you know. I'd like to interview her.
Wouldn't we all? I've got a psychiatrist in with her now. I'll let you know if we get any information. As to the items you've all gathered, it's Julia! Violet yelled, clapping her hands together. Of course, Marigold chimed in. Ned wondered who the blonde woman was. I can't believe I missed the obvious. You went to the airport to fetch her, Daisy said. Dogs fetch, Marigold said with a sniff. Once a high school English teacher, always a high school English teacher. Mort started to bounce up and down like a kid at the front of the Pirates of the Caribbean line.
I want to interview your sister.
I have not confirmed that Julia Cates has been contacted in this case, nor that she is here. Ellie looked directly at Mort. Is that clear? I don't want to see her name in print.
Maybe if you promised me an exclusive.
Stop talking.
But
Daisy whopped him in the back of the head. Mort Elzik, don't you even think of disobeying Ellie. Your mother would turn in her grave at the very thought, and Lord knows I'll call your daddy. Don't break that story, Mort. Ellie added, please, because they both knew he could do what he wanted. But they had decades of history between them. At times like this, they were more high school newspaper geek and homecoming queen than reporter and police chief. In small towns, the social dynamic was like concrete. It set early and hard.
Okay, he said, drawing the word out into a whine.
Ellie smiled. Good. Daisy said, what do we do with the supplies, Chief? Thank you, Daisy. Why don't you put everything in my carport? Be sure and get every donor's name. I want to tell them thanks. Marigold patted her vinyl notebook. Already done. Ellie nodded. Good. I knew I could count on you all. Now I'd best get to work. We've got an identity to track down. Thanks for all your help. That kid was lucky to stumble into our town.
We'll take care of her, someone said.
Ellie headed across the parking lot. She could hear the buzz of gossip behind her. It grew softer with each step. Tonight, at both the Bigfoot and the Poorhouse, speculation would be served more often than pitchers of Olympia beer. The subjects would be Julia and the Wolf Girl in equal proportions. She should have seen it coming. Julia had always been different in a town that prized sameness. A quiet, gawky girl who'd somehow been born into the wrong family, and then, unimaginably, proven that she was practically a genius. The townspeople hadn't known what to make of her when she belonged here. God knew they wouldn't know what to say to her now. Ellie climbed up into her mom's old Suburban, Madge to those in the know, and drove back to the station house. All the way there, she added things to her mental to-do list. Today was the day she'd find the girl's identity. It had to be. Either someone would read a newspaper and come forward, or, and this was the best answer, she would find the answer in the cold case files and become a hero. Ellie parked in her spot and went into the station. Viggo Mortensen stood in her office, not in the flesh, of course, a cardboard cutout of him
in full Lord of the Rings regalia. A white construction paper dialogue bubble had been taped next to his lips. It read, "Forget Arwen, it's you I want." Ellie burst out laughing. Peanut came around the corner and walked into the office, holding two cups of coffee. "How did you know I'd need this today?" Ellie said. Peanut handed her a cup of coffee. "A good guess." "And Aragorn, where was he hiding?"
"In the projection booth at the Rose Theater. Ned loaned him to me."
"So I have to return him?" Peanut grinned.
"Tomorrow. Maybe the next day. I told Ned it'd be a while, seeing how badly you need a man in your bedroom. Ned said cardboard was better than nothing."
Ellie couldn't help smiling. "Thanks, Peanut." Then she thought of her to-do list, and it was easy to let go of that smile. "Well, I guess we'd best get to work." Peanut reached down to her cluttered desk and pulled up a single sheet of paper from the mess.
"Here's where we are so far." She put on her rhinestone-encrusted Costco reading glasses. "The Center for Lost and Missing Children is running a database search. Their first pass brought up over 10,000 potential matches. They're trying to narrow it down. Her exact age would help."
Ellie slowly sat down. Her dream of heroism fizzled like an old balloon. 10,000 missing girls? God help us, Peanut. It would take us decades to go through all that information.
"Get this, Elle. There are 800,000 missing children cases a year in this country. That's almost 2,000 a day. Statistically, 50% of them will be white girls kidnapped by someone they know. Is she white for sure?"
"Yes." Ellie felt overwhelmed suddenly. "Did the FBI get back to us?"
"They're waiting for proof of kidnapping or a solid identification. It could just be a lost girl from Mystic or Forks. Technically, we have no proof of a crime yet. They recommend we canvass the town again. And the DSHS is putting pressure on us to identify a temporary foster parent. We'll need to get on that. She can't stay in the hospital forever."
"Did you call the Laura Recovery Center?"
"And America's Most Wanted. And the Attorney General. By tomorrow, this girl is going to be front page news."
Peanut's face pleated into worried folds.
"It won't be easy to hide, Julia."
This story was going to be a hurricane of publicity, no doubt about it. And once again, Dr. Julia Cates would be in the eye of the storm. "No," Ellie said, frowning. "It won't." Girl is coiled up like a young fern in this too white place. The ground is cold and hard. It makes her shiver sometimes and dream of her cave. While she was asleep, the strangers changed her. She smells now of flowers and rain. She misses her own scent. She wants to close her eyes and go to sleep, but the smells in here are all wrong. Her nose itches most of the time, and her throat is so dry it hurts to swallow. She longs for her river and the roar of the water that is always leaking over the steep cliff not far from her cave. She can hear the sun-haired her breathing and her voice. It is like a thunderstorm, that voice, dangerous and scary. It makes her scoot closer to the end of the place. If she were a wolf, she could burrow through it and disappear. The idea of that makes her sad. She is thinking of her, of him, even, of Wolf. Without them, she feels lost. She can't live in this place where nothing green is alive and the air stinks. She shouldn't have run away. Him always told her it was cold and bad beyond their wood, that she had to stay hidden because in the world there were people who hurt little girls worse than him did. Strangers. She should have listened. but she'd been so scared for so long.
Now she will be hurt worser than the net. They are waiting to hurt her when she comes out,
but she will be too small for them to see. Like a green bug on the leaf, she will disappear.
Sitting on an uncomfortable plastic chair in the cheerily decorated playroom, Julia stared down at the notebook in her lap. In the last hour, she'd talked endlessly to the girl hidden beneath the bed, but had received no response. Her notebook remained full of questions without answers. Teeth, dental work, deaf, stool, any evidence of diet, toilet trained, scars, age of, ethnicity. In the early years of her residency, it had become clear to everyone that Julia had a true gift for dealing with traumatized and depressed children. Even the best of her teachers and colleagues had come to her for advice. She seemed innately to understand the extreme pressures on today's kids. All too often they ended up on the dark back streets of downtown wherever, selling their thin bodies to pay for food and drugs. She knew how exploitation and abuse and alcohol marked a child, how families lost their elasticity and snapped apart, leaving each member adrift and searching. Most importantly, she remembered how it felt to be an outsider. And though she'd grown up and merged into the traffic of adulthood, those painful childhood memories remained. Kids opened up to her, trusted her to listen to them, to help them. Although she hadn't specialized in autism or brain damage rehabilitation or mental challenges, she dealt with those patients, of course. She knew how autistics functioned and reacted. She knew, too, how profoundly deaf children acted before they'd learned sign language. Astoundingly, there were still places in this country, backwoods settlements and such, where deaf-mute children grew up with no ability to communicate. But none of that seemed relevant to this case. The child's brain scan showed no lesions or anomalies. The girl under the bed could be a perfectly normal child who'd been lost on a day hike and was now too terrified to speak up. A perfectly normal girl who traveled with a wolf and howled at the moon and seemingly didn't know what a toilet was for. Julia put down her pen. She'd been silent for too long. Her best hope with this child lay in connecting. That meant communication. "I guess I can't write my way to understanding you, can I?" she said in gentle, soothing tones. "That's too bad, because I enjoy writing. Probably you prefer drawing. Most girls your age do. Not that I know your age exactly. Dr. Saracen believes you're about 6. I'd say you're a little younger, but I haven't really gotten a good look at you, have I? I'm 35. Did I tell you that? I'm sure it seems old to you. Frankly, in the last year, it started to feel old to me, too." For the next 2 hours, Julia talked about nothing. She told the girl where they were and why they were here, that everyone wanted to help her. It didn't matter so much what she said as how she said it. The subtext on every word was, "Come on out, honey. I'm a safe place." But there had been no response whatsoever. Not once had so much as a finger appeared out from beneath the bed. She was about to start talking about how lonely the world could sometimes feel when a knock at the door interrupted her. There was a scuffling sound under the bed. Had the girl heard the knock? "I'll be right back," Julia said in a quite ordinary, "Oh, there's someone at my door," voice. She went to the door and opened it. Dr. Saracen cocked his head to the right, where two white-clad male orderlies stood. One held a large box, the other held a tray of food. "The food and toys are here."
"Thanks."
"No response yet?"
"No, and it's impossible to diagnose her this way. I need to study her. Actions, reactions, movements. That damn bed makes it impossible."
What you want us to do with this stuff?
Asked one of the orderlies. I'll take the stuffed animals. Store the rest of the toys for now. She's hardly ready for that kind of play. The food can go on the table, and be quiet. I don't want to scare her any more than she already is. To Max, she said, Does this town still have a library the size of my car?
It's small, he admitted, but with the internet you have access to everything. The library went online last year.
He smiled charmingly.
There was a parade.
She felt a moment's connection to him then. They were the outsiders, laughing at small-town customs. When she realized that he'd made her smile, she stepped back. There always is. She started to say something else. She wasn't even sure what, when it struck her. Move the bed. How had she missed the obvious? She spun around and shut the door, realizing a moment too late that she'd shut it in Max's face. Oops. Oh, well. She went to the nearest orderly who was just setting down a tray of food and said, Take the bed out of here, please, but leave the mattress.
Huh? We're not furniture movers, miss,
the other man said. Doctor, she pointed out, are you telling me that you two aren't strong enough to help me?
Of course we're strong enough, the taller man sputtered as he set down the box of stuffed animals.
Good. Then what's the problem?
Come on, Fredo, let's move the bed before the doc here starts wanting a fridge.
Thank you. There's a child under there. Try not to scare her.
One of the men turned to her. Why don't you tell her to come out?
Just move the bed, please. Carefully. Put the mattress in the corner.
They placed the mattress where she'd indicated, lifted the bed off the floor, and backed out of the room. The door clicked shut behind them, but Julia didn't notice. All she saw was her patient. Crouched low, the girl opened her mouth to scream.
Come on, Julia thought. Let me hear you.
But there was no sound as the child scrambled back to the wall and froze. She went perfectly still. Julia was reminded of a chameleon settling into its environment. But the poor kid couldn't change color, couldn't disappear. She was all too noticeable against the speckled gray linoleum floor and bright yellow wall. So still, she seemed to be carved of pale wood. Her only sign of life was her nostrils, which flared as if to pick up every scent. For the first time, Julia noticed the child's beauty. Though the girl was wretchedly thin, she was still striking. She stared near Julia, but not quite at her, as if there were a dangerous animal to Julia's left that bore watching. Her expression was both bland and strangely obsessive. It gave nothing away, but missed nothing either. There was no curve to her mouth at all, no indication of displeasure or curiosity. And her eyes, those amazing blue-green eyes, were serious and watchful. Julia was surprised by the lack of fear in those eyes. Perhaps she was looking at the other side of fear. What happened to a child when fear had been the norm forever? Did it melt into watchfulness? You're almost looking at me, she said in as conversational a tone as possible. Eye contact was important. Autistics routinely didn't make eye contact until or unless they'd undergone significant therapy. On her pad, she wrote, mute. Her sister had said the girl made noises, but Julia hadn't heard it for herself. Besides, her sister had also implied prodigious jumping and tree climbing skills.
I imagine you're scared.
Everything that's happened to you since yesterday has been frightening. It would make anyone cry. There was no reaction at all. For the next 12 hours, Julia sat quietly in a chair. She observed everything she could about the girl, but that wasn't much, to be truthful. In all those early hours, the child was almost completely motionless. Sometime around midnight, she fell asleep, still crouched against the wall. When she finally slumped to the floor, Julia cautiously moved toward her, picking her up gently and transferring her to the mattress.
All through the night, Julia watched the girl sleep, noticing how often she seemed seized by bad dreams. At some point, Julia fell asleep too, but by 7 the next morning, she was awake again, ready to go. She called home to tell Ellie that she'd probably spend the day at the hospital, then went back to work. When the girl finally woke, Julia was ready. Smiling easily, she began talking again. In her voice, she made sure the girl heard acceptance and caring, so that the meaning was clear, even if the words were unknown. Hour after hour, Julia talked, all through the breakfast and lunch, which went uneaten. By late afternoon, two things had become true. Julia was exhausted, and the girl had to be hungry. Julia moved very slowly over to the box that had been delivered yesterday. She was careful to make no sudden moves. She talked in a steady, soothing cycle of words, as if the child's silence were the most natural thing in the world. "How about if we look through this stuff now and see if you like any of it?" She opened the box. A stuffed gray wolf pup lay on a pile of other plush toys and folded clothes. She picked it up and then went to the next box. Still smiling, she started to unpack it. "The people of Rain Valley sent you this stuff because they're worried about you. I'm sure your parents are worried, too. Maybe you got lost. That wouldn't be your fault, you know, and no one would be mad at you." She glanced back at the girl who was sitting up on the mattress now, perfectly still, staring just past Julia. "The window," Julia realized. The girl hadn't taken her gaze away from the window. Though the glass wasn't big and didn't reveal much of the outside world, there was a patch of blue sky and the green tip of a fir branch. "You're wondering how to get out there, aren't you? I'd like to help you get home. Would you like that?" There was no reaction, not even to the word home. Julia grabbed a big book off the shelf and dropped it on the floor. It hit with a loud thwack. The girl flinched. Her eyes widened. She glanced at Julia for a heartbeat, then scurried over to the corner. "So, you can hear. That's good to know. Now I need to figure out if you can understand me. Are you hearing words or sounds, little girl?" Cautiously, she moved toward the child. All the while, she was waiting for a flicker in the eyes, an acknowledgement that she was being approached. There was none, but when Julia was about 8 feet away, the girl's nostrils flared. A tiny, whimpering sound leaked past her lips. The tension in her laced fingers turned the tanned skin almost white. Julia stopped. "That's close enough, huh? I'm scaring you. That's good, actually. You're responding normally to this strange environment." She bent down very slowly and tossed the stuffed animal to the girl. It landed right by her side. "Sometimes a soft toy can make us feel better. When I was a girl, I had a pink teddy bear named Tink. I took her everywhere." She went back to the table and set the box on the floor, then sat down. A moment later, there was a knock at the door. At the sound, the girl scrambled farther into the corner, crouching down to appear as small as possible. "It's just your dinner. I know it's early, but you have to be hungry. I'm not leaving you to eat alone. You might as well understand that now." She opened the door, thanked the nurse for the food, then returned to the table. The door clicked shut again, leaving Julia and the child alone. As Julia unpacked the food, she kept up a steady stream of conversation. Nothing too personal or intense, just words. Each one of them was an invitation that came back unopened. Finally, she pushed the box aside. On the table, there was now an array of kid-friendly food. Macaroni and cheese, from a box just the way kids liked it. Glazed donuts, brownies,
chicken tenders with ketchup, milk, jello with fruit chunks, cheese pizza, and a hot dog with fries. The tempting aromas filled the small room. I didn't know what you liked, so I pretty much ordered everything. Julia reached over and plucked a donut off the red plastic plate. I can't remember the last time I had a glazed donut. They're not good for you. But oh man, are they good. She took a bite. The flavor exploded in her mouth. Savoring it, she looked directly at the girl. I'm sorry. Are you hungry? Maybe you'd like a bite. At the word hungry, the girl flinched. For just a moment, her gaze skittered across the room and came to rest on the table of food. Did you understand that? Julia said, leaning ever so slightly forward. Do you know what hungry means? The girl looked at her for a moment. It lasted less than a breath, but Julia felt its impact all the way to her toes. Understanding. She'd bet her degrees on it. Very slowly, Julia reached for a second donut. She placed it on a red plastic plate and then stood up. She walked closer to the girl than she'd been before. This time, there was about 6 feet between them. Once again, the child snorted and whimpered and tried to back up, but the wall pinned her in place. Julia set the plate on the floor and gave it a little push. It skidded across the linoleum. Close enough to the child that she could smell its vanilla-y sweetness. Far enough away that she had to move forward to take it. Julia returned to her seat. Go ahead, she said. You're hungry. That's food. This time the girl looked right at her. Julia felt the desperate intensity of those blue-green eyes. She wrote down, food. No one will hurt you, Julia said. The girl blinked. Was that a reaction to the word hurt? She wrote it down. Minutes passed. Neither one of them looked away. Finally, Julia glanced at the window by the door. Doctor, better looking than God, was there, watching them. The second Julia glanced away, the girl ran for the food, snatched it up, and returned to her spot, like a wild animal returning to its lair to feed. And the way she ate. The girl put most of the donut into her mouth and started to chew loudly. Julia could tell when the taste kicked in. The girl's eyes widened. Can't beat a good donut. You should taste my mom's brownies. They were delicious. Julia stumbled slightly over the past tense of the word. The odd thing was she would have sworn the child noticed, though she couldn't have said why she thought so. You'd better have some protein with that, kiddo. Too much sugar isn't good. She got a hot dog and doctored it up with ketchup and mustard, then set it down on the floor about 2 feet closer to the table than before. The girl looked at the empty plate where the donut had been. It was obvious that she recognized the difference. She seemed to be gauging the additional distance, calculating additional risk. You can trust me, Julia said softly. No response. I won't hurt you. The girl's chin slowly came up, those blue-green eyes fixed on her. You understand me, don't you? Maybe not everything, but enough. Is English your first language? Are you from around here? The girl glanced down at the hot dog. Nia Bay, Joyce, Squim, Forks, Sappho, La Push, Mystic. Julia watched closely for a reaction. None of the local towns prompted a response. A lot of families go hiking in the forest, especially along Fall River. Had the girl blinked at that? She said it again. Fall River.
Nothing. Forest. Trees. Deep woods. The girl looked up sharply. Julia got up from her seat and very slowly moved toward the girl. When she was almost close enough to make contact, she squatted down so that she and the child were at eye level. Reaching behind her, she felt around for the hot dog plate. Finding it, she grasped the plastic rim and held the plate of food forward. "Were you lost in the woods, honey? That can be so scary. All that darkness, all those sounds. Did you get separated from your mommy and daddy? If you did, I can help you. I can help you go back where you belong." The girl's nostrils flared, but whether from the words or the scent of the hot dog, Julia couldn't be sure. For a moment there, maybe at the word back or help, there had been a flash of fear in those young eyes. "You're afraid to trust me. Maybe your mom and dad told you not to talk to strangers. That's normally good advice. But you're in trouble, honey. I can only help you if you'll talk to me. How else can I get you home? You can trust me. I won't hurt you," she said again. "No hurt." At that, the girl inched slowly forward. Not once did her gaze waver or lower. She stared directly at Julia as she scuttled forward in her awkward crouch. "No hurt," Julia said again as the girl neared. The child was breathing fast. Her nostrils were blowing hard. Sweat sheened her forehead. She smelled vaguely of urine because of the diapers they'd been unable to change. The hospital gown hung slack on her tiny body. Her toenails and fingernails were long and still slightly grimy. She reached for the hot dog, grabbed it in her hands. She brought it to her nose, sniffed it, frowning. "It's a hot dog," Julia said. "Your parents probably brought them on the camping trip. Where did you go on that trip? Do you remember? Do you know the name of your town? Mystic? Forks? Joyce? Where did your daddy say you were going? Maybe I could go get him." The girl attacked her. It happened so fast that Julia couldn't respond. One second she was sitting there talking softly. The next she felt herself falling backward, hitting her head on the floor. The girl jumped on Julia's chest and clawed at her face, screaming unintelligible words. Max was there in an instant, pulling the girl off Julia. Dazed, Julia tried to sit up. She couldn't focus. When the world finally righted itself, she saw Max sedating the child. "No!" Julia cried, trying to get to her feet. Her vision blurred. She stumbled. Max was back at her side, steadying her. "I've got you." Julia wrenched away from him and fell to her knees. "I can't believe you sedated her. Damn it! Now she'll never trust me." "She could have hurt you," he said in an irritatingly matter-of-fact voice. "She's all of what, 45 pounds? Her cheeks hurt. So did the back of her head. She couldn't believe how fast the attack had come on. She let out a shaky breath and glanced around the room. The girl lay on a mattress by the back wall, asleep. Even in slumber, she was curled into a tight ball, as if the whole world could hurt her. Damn it! How long will she sleep?
Not more than a few hours. I think she was looking for a weapon when I came in. If she'd found one, she could have really hurt you.
Julia rolled her eyes. No doubt he was one of those people whose lives had never been touched by violence of any kind. It's hardly the first time I've been attacked by a patient. I doubt it'll be the last. Part of the job description. Next time, don't sedate her without asking me. Okay?
Sure.
She frowned. The movement hurt. The question is, what did I say?
What do you mean?
You saw her. She was fine. I thought maybe she was even understanding a few words. Then, bam! I must have said just the wrong thing. I'll listen to the tapes tonight. Maybe that will give me a clue. She looked back at the girl. Poor baby.
We should get you cleaned up. Those scratches on your cheek are pretty deep, and God knows what kind of bacteria is under her fingernails.
Julia could hardly disagree. As they walked down the hallway, she realized how much her head hurt. So much that she felt queasy and unsteady. I've never seen anyone move so fast. She was like a cat.
Daisy Grimm swears she flew into the maple tree on South Park.
Daisy still carrying Fred's ashes around with her?
She is.
Fred died when I was in 7th grade. Need I say more? Max guided her into an empty examining room.
Sit.
Let me guess. You have dogs.
He smiled. Just sit down. I need to look at your injuries.
She was too weak to argue, so she sat on the end of the table. Paper rustled beneath her butt. Other than their breathing, it was the only sound in the room. His touch was surprisingly gentle on her face. She'd expected him to be clumsier, a little uncertain. This was nurse's work, after all. She winced when he dabbed the antiseptic on her wounds.
Sorry.
It's not your fault. He was too close. She shut her eyes. That was when she felt his breath on her cheek, a little stream of it that smelled of red-hot gum. She opened her eyes. He was right there, looking at her, blowing cool breath on her cuts. Her heart skipped a beat. Thanks, she said, jerking backward, trying to smile. Oh, for God's sake, Julia. She'd always been uncomfortable around good-looking men.
Sorry. He didn't seem sorry at all. I just wanted to help.
Thanks. I'm fine. He closed up the supplies and stowed everything back in the overhead cabinets. When he turned back to face her, he kept a certain distance between them.
You should take the rest of the day off. Have Ellie watch you. Concussions.
I know the risks, Max, and the symptoms. I'm sure I don't have a concussion, but I'll be careful.
It wouldn't hurt to lie down for a while.
She saw the way he smiled when he said, lie down, and it hardly surprised her. No doubt he was the type of man who could find a sexual innuendo in every conversation. That little girl is counting on me, Max. I need to go to the police station, and then to the library, but I'll take it easy.
Why do I think you don't know how to take it easy?
She frowned. That did surprise her. She wouldn't have pegged him as the kind of man who really understood women.
Loved them, yes. Used them, certainly. But understood them? No. Philip had never been very intuitive.
Am I that transparent?
As glass. How are you getting to the station?
I'll call Ellie.
I could give you a ride.
She slid off the table. This time when she stood, she felt a little steadier. She was about to say, that's not necessary, when she caught a glimpse of herself in the mirror.
Wow!
She moved closer. 4 angry, seeping claw marks slashed across her left cheek. Already the skin was swelling, and it looked like she was going to wake up tomorrow morning with a black eye. She really got me.
He handed her a tube of antibiotic ointment.
I know. Thanks. She took it from him and slipped it in her pocket.
Come on. I'll take it to the station.
Instead of arguing, she fell into step beside him, but not too close. 6.
Are you sure this is how it's done? Peanut asked for at least the 10th time in as many minutes.
Do I look like Diane Sawyer? Ellie responded sharply. Whenever she got nervous, she got snippy, and this was her first press conference. She needed to do everything right, or she'd come off looking like an idiot. And if there was one thing Ellie hated, it was looking and feeling stupid. That was why she'd left college. It was better to quit than to fail.
Ellie, are you having a meltdown?
I'm fine. The police station had been transformed into a makeshift press room. They'd pushed their desks to the perimeter of the room. 10 chairs had been set up and 2 rows of 5 each in the middle. A podium, dragged from the Rotary Club's storeroom, had been placed in front of them. Cal sat at his desk answering the phones. Peanut stood in the hallway surveying the setup. For some bizarre reason, she was certain she knew how to manage this.
As if.
Ellie, at least, had some media experience. Her Uncle Joe had held a press conference once, back when she was a new recruit. Her ex, Alvin, had sworn he'd seen Bigfoot. A few local papers and 1 tabloid had shown up. And so had Alvin, drunk as a parolee. Ellie checked the chairs again. On each metal seat was a flyer held in place by a small stone. She was rereading the statement she'd prepared when Earl walked into the station. He was in full dress uniform, with his few remaining strands of hair shellacked in place. He seemed taller. Lifts in his shoes. The realization made her smile. Not that she could tease him much. She'd applied a pretty healthy amount of makeup herself. It was her first time on television, and she wanted to look good. Hey, Earl, you ready for the hoopla? He nodded. His Adam's apple bobbed up and down his thin throat.
Myra pressed my uniform. She said a man on television needed knife pleats on his pants.
That's a good woman you married, Earl.
Yes, it is.
Ellie went back to reading. She concentrated on each word, trying to memorize her lines. She barely looked up as reporters streamed in and sat down. By 6 o'clock, all of the chairs were filled. Photographers and videographers stood behind the rows of chairs.
It's time, Peanut said, coming up to her. And you have lipstick on your teeth.
Perfect. Ellie wiped her teeth and leaned forward, tapping the microphone. It thumped and whined. Sound ricocheted through the room. Several people covered their ears.
Sorry.
She eased back a little bit.
Thank you all for coming. As most of you know, we need your help. A young girl has arrived in Rain Valley. We have no idea who she is or where she is from. Our best estimates put her age at somewhere between 5 and 7 years. On your seats, you'll find an artist's sketch. She has black hair and blue-green eyes. Dental records are not yet available, but she appears to have had no fillings or other work done. She has naturally lost a number of baby teeth. Such a loss is consistent with our age assertions. We have consulted with all available state and local agencies, as well as the Center for Missing Children, and have, as yet, been unable to identify her. We're hoping that you all run this as front-page news to get the word out. Someone must know who she is.
A drawing? What the hell is that about? Someone said.
We're in the process of getting a photograph. For now, this is what's available,
Ellie answered.
Mort from the Rain Valley Gazette stood up. How come she doesn't just tell you her name?
She hasn't spoken yet,
Ellie answered.
Can she speak?
We don't have a definitive answer to that yet. Early indications, however, lead us to believe there is no physical barrier to speech.
A man wearing a Seattle Times baseball hat stood up. So she's clammed up on purpose?
We don't know yet.
Is she wounded or ill? Or crazy?
Ellie was formulating her answer when Earl stepped to the microphone and said,
We've got a famous psychiatrist.
Ellie kicked him hard.
Our very best doctors are taking care of her,
she said.
That's all we have for now. Hopefully someone will come forward who can answer some of these thorny questions for us.
I heard she had a wolf pup with her.
This from a woman near the back.
And that she jumped from a branch that was 40 feet in the air,
someone else added. Ellie sighed. Let's not get carried away by small-town rumors. The point is the identification of this child.
You're not giving us much to go on, someone said.
Ellie had said everything she had to say, but the questions just kept on coming. Her personal favorite, this from Mort.
Are you sure she's human?
From there, it was all downhill.
You're lucky it was raining this morning when I left the house. Otherwise, I'd have my motorcycle, Max said, opening the passenger door of his truck for her.
Let me guess, she said as he got into the driver's seat and started the engine. Harley Davidson.
How'd you know?
The pierced ear. I'm a shrink, remember? We tend to notice the little things. He drove out of the parking lot.
Oh. Do you like bikes?
The ones that go 70 miles an hour? No.
Too fast, too free, huh?
She stared out the window at the passing trees, wishing he would slow down. Too many organ donors.
Several blocks passed between them in silence. Finally, Max said, So, have you formed any specific conclusions about her yet?
It was the sort of question medical professionals always asked psychiatrists. They didn't understand how much time an accurate diagnosis could take, but she appreciated the return to professionalism. I can tell you what I don't think. Ruling out is always a good place to start. I don't believe she's deaf, at least not completely. I also don't believe she's profoundly mentally challenged. However, that's a hunch. As to autism, that's certainly the best guess for now, although if she is autistic, she's high-functioning.
You sound like you don't really believe that diagnosis either.
I need a lot more time to run tests. When she looked at me, her words trailed off. She was hesitant to speculate without more information. It was yet another ramification of her recent problems. She was, for the first time in her life, afraid to be wrong.
What?
She looked at me. That's the point. Not near me or through me or beside me, but at me. And sometimes she appeared to understand words. Hurt, food, hungry. Those I'd swear she understood.
Do you think a word set her off?
I have no idea. Honestly, I can't remember what I said to her.
Can she speak?
So far, it's only sounds. Expressions of the purest emotions. I can tell you this. Elective mutism is a common response to childhood trauma.
And there's been some serious trauma in her life.
Yes.
The weight of those words made the air between them feel heavy suddenly and sad. Maybe she was kidnapped, Max said quietly.
It had been on Julia's mind all day, that thought. It was the dark shadow that lay behind all her questions. That's what I'm afraid of, too. This girl's physical scars could be nothing compared to her emotional trauma.
She's lucky you're here, then.
Actually, I'm the lucky one.
The minute the words were out, Julia wished them back.
She wasn't sure why she'd revealed something so personal, and to this man she hardly knew. Thankfully, he didn't respond. He turned left onto Azalea Street and found it barricaded.
That's odd. Another broken water main, most likely.
He backed out and drove a block down Cascade, then parked.
I'll walk you in.
That's hardly necessary.
I don't mind.
Julia didn't want to make a big deal out of it, so she nodded. They walked down the quiet, tree-lined street toward the police station. It's beautiful here, she said. I'd forgotten, especially in the fall. She was just about to remark on the brightly colored leaves when she turned the corner and saw the reason for the barricade. The street was clotted with news vans. Dozens of them. Stop, she said quickly, realizing a moment too late that she'd screamed the word at Max. She spun around so fast she ran into him. His arms curled around her, steadied her. If the press saw her now, with her battered face, they'd have a field day, especially when they found out that her own patient had injured her. The station's right there. The front door. I know where the damned front door is. I need to get out of here now. He saw the news vans and made the connection. When he looked at her, she was that doctor. Let me go, she said, wrenching out of his arms. He pointed across the street. That's the Lutheran church. Go on in. I'll send Ellie. Thanks. She'd only taken a step or two when he called out her name. She turned back to him. What? He took a step toward her, but didn't say anything. She rolled her eyes. Just say what's on your mind, Max. Everyone has a damned opinion. I'm used to it. Do you want me to stay with you? Julia drew in a sharp breath and looked up at him. She was reminded suddenly of how long she'd been alone. No. But thanks. Without looking at him again, she walked away. Max walked up the concrete steps toward the police station. As he stepped inside, the reporters turned on him like a school of barracuda. When they realized he was a nobody, they turned away. He stood by the door, waiting for the press conference to end, and thinking about Julia. In that moment when she'd seen the news vans, he'd seen the emotions flash through her green eyes. Fear, hope, despair. Her vulnerability lasted for a heartbeat, maybe less, but he saw it, and he understood. Remembered. When the media turned their white-hot light on you, there was nowhere to hide. He pushed through the waning crowd. Ellie was at the podium, standing between Earl and Peanut. He pulled her aside, said sharply, "Your sister is waiting for you in the Lutheran church." Ellie winced. She was here? She was. Shit! Max was surprised by a bolt of anger. Here's a hint. Next time you gather the press, give her fair warning. I didn't think I know. What's your problem? He could hardly answer that. Just be more careful next time. Before she could say anything else, he walked away. Outside, he paused on the concrete steps of the city hall. All around him, reporters were talking among themselves and packing up their gear. An American flag flapped in the breeze overhead. Across the street, the white stone church sat huddled in the shade of a mammoth fir tree. When he looked closely, he saw the silhouette of a woman in the window. Julia. He used to be the kind of man who would cross the street now, go to her, and offer help. Instead, he went to his truck, climbed in, and headed for home. As he drove down Lakeshore Drive, the sun began its slow descent toward the lake. At his battered mailbox, he withdrew the usual stack of junk mail and bills, then turned onto his driveway, which was a ribbon of potholed gravel road that unspooled through a nearly impenetrable forest. These were the acres his great-great-grandfather had homesteaded more than 100 years ago, with the grandiose idea of building a world-class fishing and hunting lodge. But a single year in the wet, green darkness had changed the old man's mind. He'd cleared 2 acres out of the 100 he owned, and that was as far as he got. He moved to Montana and built his fishing lodge. In time, he forgot about these wild acres tucked deep in the woods along Spirit Lake. They were passed from eldest son to eldest son, as wills were read, until at last they came to Max. It was anticipated by the whole of his family that he would do with this land what had always been done with it. Nothing. Each generation had checked on the value of the acreage. Each had been surprised by how little it was worth. So they'd kept paying the taxes and ignoring their ownership of the land. If his life had unfolded as he'd expected, no doubt Max would have done the same. He parked in the garage beside the Harley-Davidson Fat Boy motorcycle that was his favorite toy, and went into the house.
Inside, he flipped the light switches. Emptiness greeted him. There were precious few pieces of furniture in the great room. To the left was a huge pine table with a single chair at one end. A gorgeous river rock fireplace covered the eastern wall, its mantle empty of decoration. In front of it was an oxblood leather sofa, a battered coffee table, and a beautiful wooden cabinet. Max tossed his coat on the sofa, then felt beneath the cushions for a remote. Within moments, a plasma TV screen rose up from the custom-made rosewood cabinet. He clicked it on. It didn't matter what was on the screen. All he cared about was the noise. He hated a quiet house. He went upstairs, took a quick shower, and changed his clothes. He was at the steamy mirror, shaving, when he thought about her again. The pierced ear. He put down his razor slowly, staring at the tiny dot in his ear. It was barely visible anymore. He hadn't worn an earring in more than 7 years. But she'd seen it. And in seeing it, she'd glimpsed the man he used to be.
"You decided to hold a press conference without warning me?"
Julia couldn't help yelling at her sister.
"Why not just tie a yellow ribbon around my throat and toss me to the wolves?" "How was I supposed to know you'd stop by? You never came home last night. But I'm supposed to plan around your movements. Who am I, Karnak the Magnificent?"
Julia sat back in the car seat and crossed her arms. In the sudden silence, rain pattered the windshield of the police cruiser.
"Maybe the media should know you're here. I'll tell them how much we believe."
"You think it would be a good thing to show my face on camera? Now? My patient, a kid, mind you, beat me up. It hardly is a ringing endorsement of my skills."
"That's not your fault."
"I know that," Julia snapped. "Believe me when I tell you they won't." It was the same thing she'd told herself a dozen times in the last 30 minutes. For a moment there, when she'd seen those reporters, she'd considered revealing herself as the doctor on this case. But it was too early. They no longer trusted her. She needed to do something right, or they'd ruin her. Again. She had to get the girl talking. And fast. This was obviously going to be a big story for a few days. Headlines would be everywhere. People would be speculating about the girl's identity. The story would probably run that she was incapable of intelligible speech because of brain damage or unwilling to talk because of fear or trauma. Nothing seized the public attention like a mystery. The press would pull at every strand. Sooner or later, Julia knew, she would be part of the story. Ellie pulled up in front of the library. The building, an old converted taxidermy shop, sat tucked up against a stand of towering Douglas fir. Night was falling fast, so the gravel path to the door could barely be seen.
"I sent everyone home for the night," Ellie said, reaching into her breast pocket for the key. "Just like you asked. And, Jules, I am sorry."
"Thanks," Julia heard the wobble in her voice. It revealed more than she would have liked.
And Ellie heard it. If things had been different between them, this was the moment when she would reach out to her sister and say, "I'm scared to face the media again."
Instead, she cleared her throat and said, "I need somewhere private to work with the child."
"As soon as we find a temporary foster parent, we can move her. We're looking for..."
"I'll do it. Call DSHS. There shouldn't be any problem getting me approved. I'll get the paperwork filled out tonight."
"Are you sure?"
"I'm sure. I can't help her an hour a week or even an hour a day. She'll be a full-time job for a while. Get the paperwork started from your end."
"Okay."
Headlights came up behind them, illuminating the cab. Moments later, there was a knock at the car window that sounded like gunfire. Julia opened the car door. Penelope stood alongside the passenger door, waving happily. Behind her was a battered old pickup truck. She was already into her sentence when Julia stepped out.
"Said you could borrow old Bertha for a while. She was his daddy's hay truck when they lived in Moses Lake. The keys are in it."
"Thank you, Penelope."
"Call me Peanut," Heck, we're practically related, with Ellie being my best friend and all.
Julia had a sudden memory of Penelope at Mom's funeral. She'd taken care of everything and everyone like a den mother. When Ellie had started to cry, Penelope bustled her out of the room. Later, Julia had seen her sitting beside Ellie on the end of her parents' bed, rocking a sobbing Ellie as if she were a child. Julia could have used a friend like that in the past year. Thanks, Peanut. Ellie got out of the cruiser and came around to where they stood. Her police-issue black heels crunched the gravel. As they stood there, the clouds drifted away to reveal a watery moon. Get in the car, P. I'll walk her to the front door. Peanut fluttered her fingers in a sorority girl wave and lowered herself into the cruiser, slamming the door shut. Julia and Ellie walked up the gravel path to the library. As they neared the entrance, moonlight fell on the "Reading is Fun" poster that filled the front window. Ellie unlocked the door and opened it, leaning forward to flick on the lights. Then she looked at Julia. Can you really help this girl? Julia's anger slipped away, along with the residue of her fear. They were back on track, talking about what mattered. Yes. Any progress on her identity? No. We've input her height, weight, eye, and hair color into the system, so we're narrowing the possibilities down. We've also photographed and logged the scarring on her legs and shoulder. She has a very particular birthmark on her back left shoulder, too. That's the one identifying mark we know has always been on her. The FBI advised me to keep it secret, to weed out the kooks and crackpots. Max sent her dress to the lab to look for fibers, but I'm sure the dress is homemade, so it won't give us a factory. Maybe DNA, but that's a real long shot. Her fingerprints don't match any recorded missing kids. That's not unusual, of course. Parents don't routinely fingerprint their kids. We've got her blood, so if someone comes forward, we can run a DNA test. Ellie sighed. In other words, we're hoping that her mother reads tomorrow's newspaper and comes forward. Or that you can get her to tell us her name. What if it was her mother that tied her up and left her to die? Ellie's gaze was steady. It was obvious that she'd thought the same thing. They both knew that the overwhelming number of child abductions were by family members. Cases like Elizabeth Smart were incredibly rare. Then you'd better get the truth out of her, she said quietly. It's the only way we can help her. Nothing like a little pressure. On both of us, believe me. Until this week, my toughest law enforcement job was taking car keys from people at the poorhouse on Friday night. We'll take it one step at a time, I guess. First off, I need a place to work with her. I'm on it. Good. Julia smiled. Don't wait up for me. I'll be home late. She stepped over the threshold and onto the serviceable brown carpeting. Ellie touched her shoulder. Jules? Julia turned. Her sister's face was half in shadow and half in light. Yes? I believe you can do it, you know. Julia was surprised by how much that meant to her. She didn't trust her voice to sound normal, so she didn't say thank you. Instead, she nodded, then turned on her heel and went into the brightly lit library. Behind her, she heard Ellie sigh heavily and say, I believe in you too, big sis. I know you can find the kid's family. Then the door banged shut. Julia winced. It had never occurred to her to return the sentiment. She'd always seen her sister as indestructible. Ellie had never needed approval the way she had. Ellie had always expected the world to love her, and the world had complied. It was unsettling to get a glimpse of her sister's inner nature. There was a vulnerability in there somewhere, a fragility that belied the tough girl meets beauty queen exterior. So, they had something else in common, after all. Julia walked around a grid of tables to the row of computers. There were five of them, four more than she'd expected, sitting on individual desks, beneath a cork bulletin board studded with book covers and flyers announcing local events. She pulled a legal-sized yellow tablet and a black pen out of her briefcase, then scouted through the interior pockets for her handheld tape recorder. Finding it, she added new batteries, turned it on, and said, "Case file 1, patient name unknown." Clicking the stop button, she sat down on the hard wooden chair and scooted closer to the screen. The computer came on with a thump buzz. The screen lit up. Within seconds, she was surfing the net and making notes. While she wrote, she also talked into the recorder. "Case number 1, patient, female child, age unknown, appears to be between 5 and 7 years of age, name unknown. Child presents with limited or no language ability. Physical assessment is severe dehydration and malnutrition. Extensive ligature-type scarring on body suggests some serious past trauma. Socialization impairment appears to be marked, as does her ability to interact in an age-appropriate manner. Child exhibited utter stillness for hours, broken by period of high excitability and irritation. Additionally, she appears to be terrified of shiny metal objects. Initial diagnosis, autism." She clicked the recorder off, frowning. It didn't feel right. She Googled autism, symptoms of, and read through the list of behaviors typically associated with autism. None of it was new information. Language delay. Some never acquire language. Lack of pleasure at being touched. Unable or unwilling to make eye contact. Ignores surroundings. May appear deaf due to ignoring of sounds or world around him or her. Repetitive physical behaviors common, i.e. hand clapping, toe tapping. Severe temper tantrums. Unintelligible gibberish. Savant abilities may develop, often in math or music or drawing. Failure to develop peer relationships appropriate to age level. The list went on. According to the DSM-4 criteria, a patient who exhibited a set number of the symptoms could reasonably be diagnosed as autistic. Unfortunately, she hadn't observed the child fully enough to answer many of the behavioral questions. Like, did the girl like to be touched? Could she exhibit reciprocal emotions? To these, Julia had no concrete answers. But she had a gut response. The girl could speak, at least some, and she could hear and understand some limited amount. Strangely, Julia was convinced that the girl's responses were normal. It was the world around her that was wrong. There was no point in running through the related diagnoses, Asperger's syndrome, Rett's syndrome, childhood disintegrative disorder, or PDD-NOS. She simply didn't have enough information. On her pad, she wrote, "Tomorrow, study social interaction, patterns of behavior, if any, motor skills." She clicked the pen shut, tapped it on the table. There was something she was missing. She went back to the computer and started searching. She had no idea what she was looking for. For the next 2 hours, she sat there, taking notes on whatever childhood behavioral and mental disorders she could find, but none of them gave her that aha moment. Finally, at around 11, she ran a Google search on lost children. That took her to a lot of television movies and kidnapping sites. That was her sister's job. She added woods to the search to see how many similar cases there were of children lost or abandoned in a forest or national park. "Feral children" came up. It was a phrase she hadn't seen in print since her college days. Below it was the sentence fragment, "Lost or abandoned children raised by wolves or bears in the deep woods may seem..." She moved the cursor and clicked. Text appeared on the screen. "Feral children are lost, abandoned, or otherwise forgotten children who survive in completely isolated conditions. The idea of children raised by wolves or bears is prevalent in legend, although there are few scientifically documented cases.
Some of the more celebrated such children include the three Hungarian bear boys, 17th century, the girl of Oranienburg, 1717, Peter the wild boy, 1726, Victor of Aveyron, 1797, Caspar Hauser, 1828, Kamala and Amala of India, 1920, Jeannie, 1970. The second most recent case listed had been in the 1990s. It featured a Ukrainian child named Oksana Malaya, who was said to have been raised by dogs until the age of 8. She never mastered normal social skills. Today, at the age of 23, she lived in a home for the mentally disabled. In 2004, a 7-year-old boy, also reportedly raised by wild dogs, was found in the deep woods of Siberia. To date, he had not learned to speak. Julia frowned and hit the print key. It was unlikely as hell that this girl was a true wild child. The wolf pup, the way she eats. But if she were, this child could be the most profoundly damaged patient she would ever treat. And without extensive help, the poor girl could be as lost and forgotten in the system as she'd been in the woods. Julia leaned over and took the stack of papers from the printer. On top lay the last page she'd printed. A black-and-white photograph of a little girl stared up at her. The child looked both frightened and strangely fixated. The caption below it read, "Jeannie. After 12 years of horrific abuse and isolation, she became a media sensation, the modern equivalent of the wild child raised in a California suburb. Saved from this nightmare, she was brought into the light for a short time, until, like all the wild children before her, she was forgotten by the doctors and scientists and shuffled off to her shadowy fate. Life in an institution for the mentally disabled." Julia couldn't imagine being the kind of doctor that would use a traumatized child for career advancement, but she knew that sooner or later those kinds of people would come for the girl. If the true story were as bad as she thought it could be, it would make front-page news. "I won't let anyone hurt you again," Julia vowed to the little girl asleep in the hospital. "I promise." 7. By 8 o'clock that evening, the phones finally stopped ringing. There had been dozens of press conference-related fact-checking calls and faxes and queries from the reporters who'd been here and those who hadn't bothered to come but had somehow gotten wind of the story. And, of course, the locals had arrived in a steady stream until the dinner hour, begging for any scrap of news about Rain Valley's most unexpected guest.